Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast, a show focused on inspiring and empowering you to become a better writer. Come along as we deconstruct the tips, routines, and motivations of your favorite authors. In the end, it's all about getting your story onto the page. Welcome to episode 36, How James Wade Writes. I had so much fun interviewing someone who is so aligned with the mission and philosophy of How Writers Write. In a lot of ways, I felt as if I was interviewing a philosopher writer, someone who writes these beautiful stories, but also deeply engages with the writing life. James is someone who has such a rooting in himself and in his writing that when we ended the interview, I felt some of that same energy transfer to me. I'm sure after listening to this interview, you will feel exactly the same way. I want to say thank you again to James for such a fun interview. And now, without any further ado, here is the interview with James Wade. Welcome to the How Writers Write podcast. I am your host, Brian, and today's guest is debut novelist James Wade. James is an award-winning fiction author with 20 short stories published in various literary journals and magazines. His debut novel, All Things Left Wild, was published on June 16th, 2020 from Blackstone Publishing. Two quick things on that novel. First one, I was lucky enough to read an advanced copy of James's book, and it is absolutely wonderful. Like, Cormac McCarthy fans will be like, this is similar soul here. Like, it has this beautiful take on the Western genre. I loved it. Second thing, All Things Left Wild is like up there for title of the year for me. I love that title. Anyways, James, welcome. I had a little space out there. I was like trying to find my space where I was at. James, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So I'm going to start in a different direction today. Today is the last, I think, the last recording I will do in New York City before myself and my family move west. We're moving west from New York to Denver.
What?
Which feels crazy. I kind of identify as an East Coaster, as a New Yorker. So I'm shedding my, you know, Eastern hipster writer persona and I'm going west, like go west, young man, into this new Western writer persona. And I was so happy to talk to you because I was like, James lives in Austin. He is a Western writer. He wrote a Western. And so I want to ask you, this is the most broad, abstract question possible, but what tips do you have for an East Coaster heading west as a Western writer? Like what comes to mind as I say that?
Oh man. You know, I think now it's just don't expect it to be all that different, right? I think there was a long time in our history where the East and the West were so you know, drastically different, but I don't know, you live in New York, you're moving to Denver, it's going to be smaller, you know, you won't have to wait in line as much. Things might not cost quite as much, but Denver's a big city, you know, we've got electricity out here and everything. it'd be interesting because I think maybe we should reconvene after you've been in Denver for a little bit and you can tell me what kind of some of the differences are between New York and Denver in terms of the literary community, because, you know, I'm plugged in with we have the Mountains and Plains Independent Booksellers Association, which is kind of our regional. It includes Colorado and Texas. So welcome. You're a part of that region.
Thank you.
But yeah, we have a great literary community out here, and it does tend to focus a lot on Southwestern novels, but there's some, you know, some tremendous writers in the Denver area. And yeah, we'll see. We'll see what you think about it. See, I feel like if I moved to New York, I would be the one that was expecting all the change and all right. You know, the different scene up there. I visited my agent and the Trident Media Group in New York. And of course they have the swanky downtown Manhattan offices. And, you know, for a country kid, it was pretty overwhelming. You know, I felt like I was, you know, going to the big publishing kingdom and everything. So, That being said, I don't know. I think you'll enjoy it. And I think Denver, from what I've seen, and my wife and I have visited there a few times, they have a really good, they have salons, they have, you know, poetry readings, they have the whole, you know, they have a great literary community there. So yeah. I bet you'll fit in just fine.
Yeah. I'm really excited. I've looked up a bunch of groups, and for any listeners out there who live in Denver, or any of those areas, I've actually lived in Denver just a little bit for my business life, but, reach out to me and let me know, like, what are the things I need to be plugged into. I've seen some really cool, promising places. But I'm kind of rabbit holing here, and whatever, it's, you know, my show, I get to do what I want. But, I started to think about can I wear different clothes now? Like, am I able to, like, cause I wear black almost every day, black on black, like,
sure,
6 days a week, 7 days a week. And maybe I'll wear white, maybe, or like gray, you know, that's it. And I'm like, do I get to wear like flannels now? Like, can I get like a big belt buckle? You know, like, how far can I push this thing into this new persona? Like, I don't know. Like, it's a pretty, it's a brave new world. It's a brave new world.
You can completely reinvent yourself if you want to.
I think it's time. I feel ready. So, okay, back to writing. So, I'm so happy to have you on, because I feel like, you know, I try and do a really big blend. I try and have authors who have written one gazillion books, and I try and have authors who are writing their debut novel. And both have such amazing perspectives and important perspectives to share. One of the things I always love to dig into, especially with somebody like yourself, you're two weeks out from your first novel being published, is you've climbed the proverbial writing mountain. You know, so many people think, man, if I could just get that first novel published, that would be amazing. And so I'm curious, as you stand on the top of this mountain and you look down at the incredible journey that you've been on, what are a couple of the things that stick out and you're like, you know what, this was a big deal in this journey. This changed me. This made me grow. I didn't know this. Like, what are a few of those points that stick out to you?
That's a good question. And I think I'll start by saying that as I stand on this mountain and look back, I realize that I've only made the first hill, right? And so that I remember not that long ago going, man, if I could just finish a manuscript, right? If I could just get one manuscript finished, I'd be so happy. And then maybe I have to self-publish, right? But then I'll have that one book release party with family and friends, and I'll feel so accomplished and, you know, all this stuff. But then you get close to the end of that manuscript and you think, well, maybe if I could just get an agent, right? And I would say, to circle back to your initial question, getting an agent was probably one of the biggest in terms of the professional, you know, moments. I think that, because that really solidified that there was a chance that this might get sold. And of course, then that becomes the next mountain is, oh, if I could just get a book deal. Okay, you get, you know, then we had some interest for some publishers, and I thought, well, maybe if I could just get a multi-book deal. And you get a multi-book deal and you go, well, if I could just sell X amount of copies, and I just have the feeling that that's just going to continue to push out. And it's something that I'm actually trying to work on, right? Trying to kind of live in the moment and appreciate that a little more. And so that's, you know, that's something that I would say to anybody that's starting out, is try to appreciate each of those moments. Instead of trying to push for, you want to push forward, you want to have goals, but you also don't want to get so bogged down that you're not enjoying each moment as it comes. A good friend of mine, Owen Edgerton, he's a good guy, great author. He won the Penn Award a couple years ago for his novel Hollow. It's a beautiful book. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I said, Owen, oh my gosh, you know, congratulations, you won the Penn Award. Do you now feel like you finally made it, right? Does this legitimize everything that you've been working towards? And he said, you know, it did for a few minutes. And then I just couldn't help but think, well, it's not a Pulitzer, you know? And so that's, and I think that there's a lot of that mentality, not just with writers, but, you know, with folks in general, right? We always believe that our life is about to be great, right? If we could just do this one thing, then life would be awesome. If we could just accomplish this one goal, then our career would be awesome, or our relationship would be awesome. And a lot of times that pulls us away from the moment. And so as a new writer and a young writer, I've been really trying to focus on living in the moment. And I fail a lot, you know, because I'm constantly kind of, like you said, the book came out on the 16th. So we're less than 2 weeks, you know, from when it came out, and the reviews are coming in, and there's all this stuff. And I want to both experience that and distance myself from it at the same time. But I think, so that's just kind of, a side note. But to answer your question, I think getting an agent was a huge thing because, man, those guys, they help you so much, right? They don't get paid until you get paid. So, you know, they work really hard for you, and they just open a lot of doors, certainly that I didn't have. You know, there are a ton of new writers who have connections in the literary world, be it through MFA programs or just, you know, being in certain places in the country that are these literary, you know, hotspots. But I did not have that. And so I literally knew, you know, I had no favors to call in. I didn't know who to ask, you know, to look at my stuff. And so it was just really a godsend that I was able to land an agent who was willing to say, okay, and here's how we take our first steps, you know, because I needed a lot of handholding. You know, I think a lot of new writers are not completely familiar with the way the industry works and, you know, just kind of what a writing career looks like. They may know a lot about writing, but not a lot about publishing. And that was kind of where I came in, is I had no idea, you know, the steps to take and how this was all going to pan out. And so that was, I think getting an agent was probably the single most important thing. Not that you have to have an agent to be a writer, but it just certainly something that really helped me.
Yeah. Let's pause for a second, because I want to go in two different directions. I want to talk about one incredibly underserved topic on the podcast, largely because my belief is that it's served very well in other places, is the question of like, what does it take to get an agent?
Okay.
That's covered, I feel like, extensively in the writing world. Sure. If you Google that, there's probably 10 million results in Google. I do want to hear about your journey into that though. But before we get there, I want to rewind back a little bit, because you talked about a really, something that's really close to my heart. And like you, I've had to learn a lot about this idea of enjoying and noticing each moment, good or bad. And then especially taking a moment to breathe in the accomplishment. And so, you know, you talked a little bit about this idea of slowing down and falling out of the if-then-isms, you know what I mean? If I get an agent, then... And if then, and I'm wondering, like, from your perspective, you talked about this a little bit, but what's like the antidote to that? Like, how is it writers, and we're all people as well, can escape from that treadmill to be like, I won a Penn Award, but it wasn't a Pulitzer.
Right. you know, I think just in... It's interesting because this is one of the many things that I equate with like writing and life, right? And I think that a lot of the same things that you would hear about from maybe like a life coach or something would also apply to writing. I try to meditate when I can, because that's something that forces you to stop and to be still. And you know, some sessions are better than others. Sometimes I just can't turn my brain off, and that's okay. You know, that's just, it's all about the discipline and the practice and forcing yourself to calm down a little bit. But the thing that's specific to the writing portion of that is, one of the things that I always said when I started writing, and still hold to, is that it's not about being published. It's not about selling books. It really is about the writing process, right? There's something that's magical and beautiful about that, something very therapeutic. And it's something that I love to do and would do it even if I wasn't published, even if I wasn't getting paid. No, obviously maybe I couldn't do it as much because I wouldn't have as much time, but it's something that'll never not be a part of me. And so if I focus on the process, and so if I can't turn my mind off, then I'll try to direct my mind, try to turn it to, okay, well, maybe not the next goal or accomplishment, but the next project, right? Like, what's the next, instead of worrying so much about how this novel's doing, let's look at the next novel that we're writing, or the next idea for a novel that we have. Because at the end of the day, whether you're successful or not, or whether your career has ups and downs, the one constant is going to be the writing. And so I kind of use that as, a base to return to. And then what gets a little complicated is when you do have the ups and downs, right? If you get an agent, or you get a publishing deal, or you get a good review, you want to enjoy that, but you also have to strike a balance, right? You don't want to give over too much to that joy and either A, start believing the good things they say about you, or B, get distracted from the work. So how do you pull yourself back, right? Like, how do you say, okay, well, this is a great review, or this is a terrible review? Well, either way, you want to go back to the middle, right? Mm-hmm. And so I always talk about balance in writing, balance in life. You don't want to get too high. You don't want to get too low. And there are folks who disagree with that, because they say, well, the lows are going to happen anyway, so you might as well celebrate the highs. And I think that makes a ton of sense. But for me personally, I need to be a little more even keel. And if I get too high, it makes the low that much worse, right? You know, and some people say that's maybe a pessimistic view. It's not that I expect or anticipate that bad things are going to happen, but I certainly want to be realistic and understand that bad things can happen. Good mm-hmm. things can happen. And no matter which way it goes, because often it will go both ways, I'm just going to try to stay in the middle of that and just keep writing, keep meditating, keep being me. And that's it. And that's all you can do. And like I mentioned earlier, I fail at that all the time. So it's really important to kind of forgive yourself a little bit.
Right.
If you catch yourself, kind of straying off the path, so to speak, you just got to be kind to yourself and just try again tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. What I hear as you're saying that, what I took away from like my interpretation of what you're saying, is there's a degree of setting your goals, like setting the goalposts. I talk about this a lot, but setting your goals on something that is relatively within your sphere of control.
Sure.
Right. Because, I coach a lot of writers, and you were like, it's a way of life coaching. I happen to have done my entire life coaching, training and gone through that whole curriculum. So I was like, yeah, no, that's, there you go. but what I hear a lot is this idea that there's something external to actually writing that will make us happy. And I think we do this a lot with a lot of things, and I don't want to get like too esoteric and like down into the weeds on this, but I think as people, a lot of times we tend to believe that there are things outside of our self, right? Outside of our beliefs or, internal emotions, internal wiring that can make us feel happy, because we can't do mm-hmm. it for ourselves. And I think in the writing life, because it is something we do so privately, but then send it out into the world, it's so easy to think, if the world approves of it, I must be good. And if the world doesn't approve of it, I must be bad. And, I think that's a hard thing to continue to write, knowing you're going to send this out somewhere, or eventually somebody else is going to read it. Continue to write knowing someone else will read it, but not have the value be in their opinion.
Right. So two points there, because you're absolutely right. I think you hit the nail on the head. One, the external factors, the things we can't control. That's like what I was saying. We always, that's where this whole mindfulness movement kind of came from, right? We're always going, next year is going to be so much better because this will have happened, or if I could reach this goal. And you really forget to, live in the moment and enjoy, each day. But then also, to your point about sending your work out in the world, I tell young writers this all the time. Writing is such a brave thing, because when you sit down, even though, like you said, it is a very solo act, when you sit down and write something, you're writing that knowing that it's going to be rejected, right? Either it's going to be rejected by a magazine or an agent or a publisher, or even if it's accepted by all those things, there's going to be a bad review. Even the best you know, reviewed books in the world have negative reviews. So you're writing something that you know to a certainty is going to be rejected. Somebody is not going to like it. Somebody is going to have something, you know, negative to say about it. And you still have to have the confidence or the, you know, whatever, the gumption to sit down and write it anyway and complete the work and put it out there. And if you can find a happiness in that, right, just find a peace in that process, because that's the only thing that's in your control. Mm-hmm. You know, Faulkner said that the quote is, once a novel is written, that's one book the writer never has to read. And because he knew, you know, once he was done writing, you know, and editing his manuscripts, he said he never read his books because he didn't see any good that can come from that. You know, he took pleasure in the process of making the work. And then once it was made, he didn't want to go back in because, you know, he didn't say this, but I suspect it's the same thing that I would do if I went back and nitpicked at my novel right now. I would tear it apart and you know, it'd just feel terrible about it because that's what we do, right? So you have to balance that because you have to be brave and say, I'm going to put this out in the world, while also part of your writer mind is going, this is not good. It'll never be good enough. So,
This comes back. I'm hammering on this because I really truly believe it's so important. This comes back to like the ethos of How Writers Write, of the podcast, of kind of everything that I've been doing, which is there's a lot of writers out there who know a lot about writing. Mm-hmm. They know how to plot. They know character. They know those kind of like, what details really clear. And the thing that's keeping them from writing and telling their story is not that they don't know how to plot. The thing that's keeping them from telling their story is what we're talking about is a fear and or a certain like the if-then-ism is crippling, right? So it's like, well, I will, if I get an agent or if I get a good idea or if then I'll start writing or then I'll put something out. It's almost like I think if then can provide some level of motivation, but it can also provide an incredible amount of detriment to the writer because it gets so caught in like, I'm not going to move forward until a condition is met.
The waiting is on
so hard.
The waiting on perfection, right? Like that's you know, waiting on the motivation, waiting on perfection. That stuff can just absolutely, you're right, it can just cripple you, right? You can you can have an idea, but you want to wait until you get it a little more sorted in your head, or you know, you want to sit down to write, but you want to wait till you have a little more time so that you can focus on it, and before you know it, you know, the weeks turn into months, turn into years, and that's a terrifying thought. And I certainly don't want to, you know, scare anybody away from writing if they think they may want to get started. But, you know, for me, I can't not write, you know. It's something that you have to do. And that's also kind of what's scary about it is you know, I know I have to do this. So I have to figure out how to do it well enough that I can continue to do it. Brian, your point is spot on. Yeah. That's, I think, one of the hardest things is just getting started, getting in the flow, because writing, like anything else, is you know, it's like working out, right? Like if you use a muscle over and over, that muscle gets bigger, it gets stronger. It's the same thing with writing. If you sit down and write and you build up your writing stamina, you build up your writing discipline, all those things, you know, are going to pay off in the long run. But it's just getting started, right? It's getting off the couch and going to the gym, or it's, you know, it's kind of the same principle.
Yeah, 100%. Sometimes this is met with a little bit of like, you know, maybe this sounds too harsh, and I don't mean it to be harsh. I mean it to be inspiring, and I mean it to be empowering, really, which is like, you're never going to be in a better spot than where you are right now. And I know oftentimes there's beliefs that there will be a better time. And that's just a really mischievous and hard to pin down fib we tell ourselves to get out of taking action today.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And
you know what? There may be. I think it's one of those things to where you can kind of get some folks can get lost in the technicality of that. There, in my opinion, there may be a better time, like a more ideal time. but not if you don't start now.
Correct.
Right.
Great.
So like if you start writing now and you're struggling a little bit and you're only finding time to write once a week or whatever it is, you know, there may end up being a time down the road where you do have a little more time to write. But if you haven't started, what are the odds that you're going to go, oh, I've got a week off. I think what I'll do is use this to write. Like that's, if you haven't started yet, it's very unlikely that you're going to make that decision then. So
yeah.
I would say, you know, imagine if it's hard now, but you're still doing it, imagine how great it'll be when that better time does come along, you know?
Right. And any bit of forward momentum, anything, like
absolutely
anything, 15 minutes a week. I've yet to meet somebody who is so busy that they don't have 15 minutes a week or 30 minutes a week or an hour a week. Like it's like, I'm not saying, I'm certainly not saying you need to write every single day, 3 hours a day, or don't even think about it. Right. What I'm saying is any amount of forward momentum is proving something to yourself. You need to believe, which is you are a writer and you have a story to tell and you can do it. Now it may take a long time. That's okay. That's okay. What counts is one little step at a time, one little step at a time,
that is
one little step at a time, one little step at a time. That's really all it is, right? Okay. So let's change gears a little bit because I literally could talk about this the entire time. So let's change gears a little bit. This is going to be the first time we've talked in depth I've ever discussed on the podcast about getting an agent. So I want you, for the people out there who maybe haven't heard this before, haven't done their research, the general process, why don't you kind of go through and like, you know, big, huge steps. What is the what did the process look for you, like for you? And then what were a couple of like the big tips you wish you maybe would have known before you started this process that might've made your life a little bit easier?
Gotcha. Rein me in on this if you need to, because I speak to writing groups about this topic. And so I'll try to keep it though at a, you know, at an aerial view. The first things first, if you're a writer, it doesn't matter if it's fiction, nonfiction, memoir, poetry, short story collections, whatever your project is, before you even think about getting an agent, finish what you're working on. There is nothing an agent hates more than getting a query letter, which we'll talk about in just a second, and it sounds wonderful and they are so intrigued. And, you know, maybe there's a sample chapter if that's something that the agent, you know, has requested, and they read it and they go, oh my God, this is amazing. I cannot wait to, you know, to sell this book for this author. And they say, okay, send me the full manuscript. And you go, okay, it'll be done in 4 months. Like that's just, oh, it's a killer. Right. And so just first things first, finish your work. And that in itself may sound simple, but we're writers, right? And so when is the work finished, right? Yeah, sure, we type the end and we have a plot and it's a complete plot, but is it really finished? Because maybe I could tinker with this chapter, or maybe I want to change that paragraph. And so at some point you just have to say, okay, look, if I get an agent and if I get a book deal, this is going to be looked at by an editor. It's going to, you know, there are other people that are going to see this. So just get it. If you can get it 85% or 90% of where you want it, and it's coherent and has a beginning, middle, and end, then send it to an agent, because that's not going to be the difference between that agent accepting your manuscript or not. Right. If they see potential in your writing, potential in your story, if they think it's something that they could sell, it's not going to matter that 5 or 10% that might completely derail your project if you can't get over that hump of just letting go of it and hitting send, right? That's now again, there maybe not everybody would agree with that, but that's just kind of what worked for me. Is if I didn't hit send when I did, then maybe I never would have. And so the second huge thing is learn to write a great query letter. There are classes you can take. Take a class. There are classes you can take. I took a class here in Texas with the Writers League of Texas, and because I didn't even know, I had no idea, right? That I knew what a query letter was, but I didn't know how it should be structured. I didn't know what was a do and don't, you know, in the business. And so so I took a class here at Writers League of Texas with Becca Oliver, who used to be a literary agent, and that's it. That's all I did. I took one class, And I took notes and I went and I said, okay, I'm going to take my novel and basically plug it, you know, a plug and play here of this outline of a query letter. And then I sent that to some agents, and that's essentially how, you know, how I got my agent.
And how did you find your, like, how did you find a list of agents? I know a lot of people ask me, like, I don't even know where to look. Like, where are these, where are these mysterious agents hiding in the world?
There's a lot of ways that you can go about it. I don't know. I won't say that anyone is the best way, because you can just Google literary agents and find lists that way. And you can read, pretty much every agent has something on their website that kind of says what works they like. You can look at who they represent and see, is it somebody that, you know, you think their work is comparable to yours. But outside, if you don't, you know, if you're not comfortable just Googling, that kind of stuff, you can go, there's conferences maybe not so much right now, but they're moving online now, but there's agents and editors conferences, there's writers conferences that have agents come as guests. And so you can get a little bit of FaceTime or a little bit of online virtual FaceTime with some of these agents and see if your personality clicks, or, you know, if they say something that, you know, really relates to you. Because that's the other thing is, you know, you can be a little picky, right? Even if you don't have an agent, you don't want to just sign with the first one, right? You might if it's an awesome agent, but you don't have to, is the point. The agents are out there. They want to find writers. Any agent that's, you know, currently accepting, you know, new work means that they're in the market to find new clients. And they, again, I think there is a small but vocal contingency that it feels like agents are, you know, out to get writers. And while I'm sure there have been, you know, been instances where that's true, for the most part, you know, these guys are on your side. They don't get paid until you get paid. They want you to succeed. They want to sell your book. They want to sell you, and they don't just want to sell your book. They want to sell your career most of the times, because obviously the more successful you are, the more successful they are. But each agent has their own specific kind of request, right? So an agent might say, send me a query letter and a synopsis, and then I'll get back to you. They might say, send me the first chapter or the first 10 pages or the first 5 pages. And so you really want to pay attention to that, because the first thing is that agents hate unfinished work. But the second thing is, if you can't even follow the directions on their submission form, you know, then that's going to kind of turn them off to the potential of working with you. And so be sure that, you know, you kind of, and it can get a little annoying, right? You've just written this giant manuscript and you've edited it and you've done so many drafts and now it's finally ready. And they're saying, okay, well, we want the first, you know, 10 pages, but we want it in this style and this format. And that's not the style and format that you have it in. So now you have to change that. And then the next agent wants it a different way. And so you change that. Look, just have patience. Take a few days. That's my wife helped me tremendously when it came to submitting, because she kind of had like a spreadsheet, right, of the different agents we wanted to query and what each submission, you know, what they wanted from each submission. And so we kind of just worked our way through that and just took a day to kind of sit down and do that. And then the other thing is, agent may get back to you the next day. They may get back to you the next week, next month. I mean, these, you know, it just depends on where they are in terms of, you know, what they have going on in their career. And so don't lose heart, you know, if you don't hear from them, and also don't keep following up, right? Because that's annoying. So just let them get back to you when they do. And then perhaps the most important thing for writers is, if an agent says this work is not for us, believe them, right?
Right.
Believe, don't think that they're just trying to blow you off by saying you're not a good writer.
Right.
Just believe them that, hey, you know, they read your pages. It's either not the type of writing they represent, or they really truly believe, I can't sell this book as well as somebody else could potentially sell it. So just tell yourself that. Say, you know what? If an agent tells me no, then that wasn't the agent for me. Move down the list, you know, and try somebody else, because it only takes one. That's what's so frustrating but so great about writing. If you can get one agent to convince one publisher that your novel is worth taking a shot on, you're about to be a published author, right? And so that's the percentage success that you have for that to happen is very low, because there's a ton of agents and a ton of publishers, and everybody wants something a little different. and you just have to find the person that, you know, that wants what you have.
Right. So did you have to query a lot of agents in order to find the one that represents you?
So it's interesting because I did query a lot of agents, but my agent is Mark Gottlieb with Trident Media Group, and Mark was number one. So my wife and I made two separate lists, two separate spreadsheets. Mark happened to be number one on both of our lists. And so, and he also happened to be the agent that responded the quickest. And so we had a really kind of tough decision to make, because even though Mark was our number one, he was also the first agent that responded. And did we really, and responded that he, you know, wanted to offer us, offer me representation. And so did we really want to go with the, you know, the first agent, because you always hear, don't just go with the, you know, the first person. But we thought about it. You know, I had met Mark at a conference, really liked what he had to say. He has very impressive, numbers in Publishers Weekly. He's consistently ranked near the top, as is his agent, Trident Media Group, his agency. I mean, and so ultimately we just went ahead and signed with Mark. And so that was interesting, because we actually signed with Mark and had a book deal within 8 days of that signing.
Jeez.
And then we started getting rejections from other agents. Right.
You're like, that's fine.
Yeah, sure. But it's also, it was hard not to gloat, but it was an interesting teaching lesson, right? For writers, is that was just timing is all that was. Yeah. The fact that Mark had responded the fastest and the fact that he was able to get us a deal that quickly, that was all just luck and timing. If he had been the last one to respond, right? Mm-hmm. And then you had all those rejections come in first. Think about how disheartening each of those rejections would have been. I would get a rejection and I would kind of laugh like, oh, well,
right.
But that was only because we already, you know, had the deal in place. And so that's a really good example of, if you get a rejection, don't lose heart. Don't, you know, think that, I need to go change everything about the manuscript.
Right.
So yeah, it's just kind of a good example of how timing can really, impact what you think about your own work, and it shouldn't. You know, if you have confidence in your work, then just keep querying. And the other thing is, if you never get that bite that you're looking for, that still doesn't mean that your work isn't good. Put it in the drawer, write something else. Eventually, once your career takes off, you can go back and you can tell a publisher, you know, when the publisher comes to you and says, hey, do you have anything else you're working on? You can go, oh, I've got a full manuscript, you know? Right. And so it's never a useless thing, either career-wise or just craft-wise, right? Because whatever mistakes you made in that manuscript or whatever lessons you learned, you're going to take that into your next project. It's going to be even better for it.
Yeah. I want to pause again. I keep pausing us, but I want to pause again, because I think you just mentioned something critically important in writing, and it loops back. I'm like trying to get us back to like the super philosophical conversation, but it loops back to what we were talking about, which is, if you have set your "I will be happy when I get an agent" as your goalpost, and for whatever reason you can query hundreds and not get the response you want, right? It's a fair statement to make. Sending your cold query out to zillions of agents can work. It can work, but can also not work for a myriad of reasons. But if you've made that your goalpost, you can be a wonderful, beautiful writer with a lifetime of stories to tell. But that moment can crush you, right? Which is why it reinforces this idea that setting your goalposts on something that is within your control, you can't control an agent saying yes or no to you. You just can't.
Absolutely.
Reinforcing that your goalpost being like, I am here to tell stories. I'm here to write. And so like my goalpost is to write. This is what I try and push people towards all the time, because I feel like it's the only way to stay sane as a writer. You know, if your goalpost is to write, your goalpost is to tell stories, and then the agents will come and go. The book deals will come and go when it's time and when it's ready. You have a lifetime of writing ahead of you. There's nothing that's going to stop that.
Absolutely.
Because it is a true statement that like Mark said yes, and Mark is there's a half dozen agents that if they say, I want to represent you, that's pretty much, you're good, right? Mark's in that camp. You know what I mean? Like a very well-known, phenomenal, phenomenally successful agent. But outside of like him saying yes, you could have gotten 40 no's, and all of a sudden it's like the story is really different. you know, I think it's important to reinforce that. Yeah.
Well, and also, you know, folks should understand that what you're saying, which is absolutely correct, is also nuanced. We're not saying that if you get 100 rejections that you can't be disappointed, right? We're like, sure. you're a human, you have emotions. Sure. We're not saying that you have to jump out of bed, you know, after your 100th rejection and go, oh my God, life is beautiful and I can't wait to write. You know, so there is some nuance there, but the overall point is we're trying to keep you out of like that dejection where you're like, where you don't want to write anymore. Right. Or where your writing starts to be really influenced by what you think an agent might want or something like that, which is also a dangerous thing. Right. I know some writers who like to kind of surf agent websites, see what those folks are looking for. You know, there was something a few years ago where an agent tweeted, we're really looking for, spunky grandmas as like the narrators, right? Like we want like old feisty narrators. And that's what that agent was looking for. And I had a writer friend of mine go, yeah, I think I'm just going to do it. I think I'm just going to write a, I think I'm just going to write a manuscript based off this one agent's tweet about spunky grandmas. And I was, and there was something that was just so, you know, so comical about that, you know, it was funny, but at the same time, you know, don't do that. Right. Like unless you were going, you know, I think I've got a great idea for a book about a spunky grandma. And then you see that tweet and maybe that's what, you know, really jumpstarts you or whatever, but don't bend to what people want, because in publishing, by the time that you've written your manuscript and got the agent and the deal and the book comes out, nobody's going to be thinking about spunky grandmas anymore. Right. You know, there's so many poor authors that are sitting on piles of vampire fiction because they wrote it during the vampire fiction craze. But by the time that they, you know, went to submit it, we were kind of past that, you know, and it was almost like a Nickelback type scenario where it was, you know, a lot of people liked it, but now they won't ever admit that they did.
Right, right. Yeah. That was a tweet for serendipity, not like a challenge. like hopefully somebody out here has already done this. Like,
Exactly.
So James, okay, you've got your first book done. Like what comes next? What's next in the road for you? What is the next season of life like?
Okay. So this is another good lesson for writers, because everybody says, well, have you started writing your second novel yet? Yeah. So I'm currently on my fourth novel. So I signed a 3-book deal with Blackstone Publishing, based on my first novel, which was in 2018 that we kind of made that an initial agreement. And so in 2019, I turned in my second novel. And in 2020, I turned in my third novel just last month.
Cranking them out, man.
And so, cranking them out, and which is, it's really good that I did that, because my wife just gave birth to our first child, who is 5 weeks old. And so if I was trying to work on a novel right now and had a deadline that I was up against, that would be pretty brutal. So I'm glad that I kind of, you know, kind of got those out of the way. But that's the lesson there, or the reality check there, is in just how slow the publishing industry moves. So my second novel will come out June 8th of 2021. And I'll, you know, at that point, I'll hopefully be done with the fourth novel. And so it's very sporadic in the timing of everything. It's a lot of hurry up and wait. You know, you'll get a deadline on some little aspect of the novel that is pretty immediate, but then you're still a year away from publishing. And so there's kind of like a new reality that sets in, and is just now setting in, because again, I'm, you know, this is my first novel that I've had published. So I'm still learning and seeing a lot of how all this works about advanced reader copies and blurbs and, you know, all these things. But now that I've kind of absorbed all this, at least for the first go around, I think I'm a little more informed. I'll be a little less anxious for the second book to come out, and then the third. And so what I'm working on right now, is my fourth novel, but I have a little more time to do it. We've been doing a lot of marketing with the first book, which, you know, I don't mind saying here, it's just awful. It's miserable. Like the market, like just to promote self-promotion, especially during, you know, with everything that's going on, it just feels so disgusting, you know? It's like, hey, everybody, please, please wear a mask, please social distance and stay safe because this is a really serious global pandemic. And also Black Lives Matter. And we have to have this really important conversation about racial injustice. And also buy a book from me, buy a literary Western by a white guy. So, you know, it's not ideal timing. I think the next chapter in my life is really up in the air, kind of as everybody's is right now, because we don't, here in Texas, you know, I know that in New York, you guys, you know, were hit hard early on. Yeah. Here in Texas, we're setting a record every day for new cases. Yeah. We opened up arguably way too soon. And so we're kind of in the throes of the biggest part of our coronavirus crisis. And, you know, we have the new baby. And so we're kind of extra hypersensitive about all this. And so I'm trying to write, I'm trying to create. And the other kind of stipulation, and this goes back to kind of the industry, is so my 3-book deal with my publisher is essentially up, right? I've written 3 manuscripts. They've accepted those 3 manuscripts. And while of course I'll still work with editors and cover designers and the books will still, you know, will not, the third one will come out in 2022. As far as the fourth novel I'm working on, it doesn't have a home unless I were to go to my publisher and try to sell it, you know, on the strength of a sample chapter or something like that, which you can, you know, again, I said, you have to finish your work to find an agent. If you have a publisher, then oftentimes you can, you know, sell them, you know, pitch them your next novel without it being complete. And so I'm trying to get to that point because I do love my publisher and, you know, want to stick with them. And so that's the other thing. If I would have to finish this novel, if I were going to have my agent then go and try to sell it to a different publisher, right? Because they don't know who I am. Just some more little industry tidbits there. But to bring it back to just writing in general, I've heard this from a lot of writers that it's really hard to create right now, just with so much going on. For me, I haven't found that in terms of like the outside influence. If anything, it's making me want to push further into the writing just to block everything else out. But with the birth of my daughter, I've had to sacrifice willingly a lot of time. Yeah. And so I haven't had, the routine has been very, I'm a very routine person, and the writing routine has been completely blown to shit. So, you know, now it's dirty diapers and poorly sung lullabies and, watching, you know, The Wire reruns at 4 in the morning and, you know, trying to rock my daughter to sleep. But it's been a beautiful thing. And I guess that's the other thing, is never in my life has writing taken such a back seat, you know, it kind of shows you what, you know, really is important and hopefully helps with what we were talking about living in the moment and not, you know, tying your happiness as a writer or as a person to external forces.
Yeah. Well, first, congrats on the newborn.
Thank you, sir.
You are remarkably coherent for having a 5-week-old. I know when my first daughter was born, those first few months, I remember thinking distinctly, I will never write another sentence for the rest of my life. Like, it will never happen. I'll never write it. And so the fact that you're here and talking, you know, your face looks nice, is not a big bag, you know, is wonderful. I think you're right. There is, when you dimensionalize writing, it's really nice, you know, to have other things that it butts up against. And for, you know, children, I think are wonderful, but, you know, some people don't have kids. And so there's all sorts of things that also have value in our life that,
oh, absolutely.
I think sometimes we're afraid will take away from our creative self or take away from writing. I have found on the things, children, you know, my wife, you know, different parts of my health, like that's kind of in that like sphere of really, really critical and important to me. Those things, when I deeply invest in those things, I become a better version of myself and therefore a better writer. And so there's a weird kind of like symbiosis there that forms where even though you might have less time and your routine is destroyed, and you know, as your daughter gets older, there'll be all sorts of, you know, craziness that comes along with that. I'm a little ahead in season wise with my kids, but it certainly it matures you with those extra things that help your writing life. They don't detract, which I think is a really beautiful part of being a person. It's good absolutely that it's that way. You know?
And you make a good point about not just those big things that don't have to do with writing, but almost every little decision. I mean, if you really wanted to get into it, you talk about your health. Okay, well, there's so much research out there about food that's good for your brain.
Right.
You know what I mean? About food that gives you energy. If you exercise, you're going to have more energy. There are so many ways, and all of that goes back to writing, because if you're feeling lethargic and you're feeling, mentally foggy, then you're going to be much less likely to A, even sit down to write, or B, if you actually do get there, the words aren't going to come as easily. Right. Your thoughts are going to be, it's a little harder to pull out of your head. And so, I'm not saying that you have to devote every breath of your life to making the perfect writer, like it's some kind of chemistry experiment. But there are things that you can pay attention to that have nothing to do with writing, seemingly, that actually really affect how efficient you're able to maintain a workload.
Right. Yeah. It's funny you say that. The How Writers Write is actually going to start doing a pretty hard pivot in this next season, next 30 to 60 days, into connecting the relationship of our body to the writing process.
Yeah.
And really highlighting that. That's something I've been really passionate about for a long time, is how the body can be a tremendous ally to writers and can teach you things and can give you energy, but also can access emotions and has a stored story. Try saying that five times fast. Stored story within it that is tremendously powerful. It's not, writing just isn't done with our head, said exactly. Another way, right? It's done with our entire being, our body being a representation of that. So
boy, where were you 3 or 4 years ago, Brian? I could have used a few of your classes, I think.
If only. All right. So, sir, I'm sorry to say this, but it's true. We have reached the time, the top of the hour, where it is time for me to ask you the final four questions. So I know you listen to the podcast and you know what these questions are. For whatever reason, if this is your first episode listening to the podcast, I'm going to tell you that these are the same four questions I ask every single writer. And I love it. It's almost always one of my favorite parts. The answers are always varied. And it highlights, the reason I do this is because it highlights diversity. Like, we are all, our unifying trait is we're all writers. We all love to tell stories. After that, we have incredible diversity, and that is to be celebrated, which is why I ask these questions, because it's a baseline to hear all of the different answers, and they're all great answers, right? And so, with that said, let us dive into the first question, which is, if you had to, I love this question, if you had to pick a spirit book, and so this is a book that, like, sometimes I say if you died and were reincarnated, you'd be reincarnated as this book. It can be a book that you think defines you the best. It's just a book that you're like, this has incredible resonance to me. I'm going to add an asterisk to this, which is, it cannot be your book. Okay. What book would it be?
Oh, God bless anybody that had to be reincarnated as my book. So anybody that's ever heard or read an interview with me knows that I am a Cormac McCarthy fanatic. I think he's our greatest writer. I don't really think it's a close race, but so I wanted to pick a Cormac McCarthy book for the answer to this question. And in a quote comes to me, I don't know if it was Thomas Wolfe. It was one of the fathers of American fiction. They said, we are the characters we are. And what that means for this question is, I really wanted to pick All the Pretty Horses, because it's just got this romanticism and this poetic, this almost nobility, to the characters, and right and wrong. But I'm not going to pick that because it would be dishonest. I am much closer to Sutri from Cormac McCarthy. And I think the reason is I think Sutri is a rambling longing of a novel, right? It's just, it follows, you know, Cornelius Sutri as he basically just walks around Knoxville and in the Smoky Mountains, and he has this longing that we don't even know what it is. We can't, and we never learn what it is, but he obviously has something that's kind of eating at him, and he's an observer of the world, of both its pain and beauty and suffering, but without understanding it, with understanding that he can't understand it, that he'll never understand it. And so he just does his best to make of it what he will. And so I think that's my spirit book. I think if I were reincarnated, I would hope to come back on the plains of Mexico as, you know, as a horse, as a horse worker. But I think I would probably end up in a houseboat on the Tennessee River, just drinking and fishing with Sutri.
it's interesting you pick that book because I think it's one of his absolute underrated novels. It's one of his most reflective. Like, you know, a lot of Cormac McCarthy is gonna beat you over the face with the theme.
I mean, sure.
And it almost is as if it's from a different writer. Like, it's just a very different tone and pace. And, you know, the level of violence is incredibly different than, you know what I mean? Like,
it's got comedy. You know, and there are some comical moments in other McCarthy, but it's not anywhere close to that. It's a little autobiographical. He wrote it as he was getting sober. And so a lot of folks think it was kind of his farewell to that life. And so, you know, and that's the other thing about McCarthy is most writers will tell you exactly what, you know, they were thinking or what they were doing for certain books. But since he's given, you know, what, 2-3 interviews ever, Sutri doesn't come up, to your point. Right, you know, everybody wants to ask him about the road or all the pretty horses or something. But yeah, I love that novel. I love all his novels. But I think that even though that's not the novel I aspire to in terms of spirit book, I think that if I was being honest, that's probably where I'd land.
Okay. All right. Question number two, is there a specific tool, can be anything at all, that you absolutely must have to write?
There's really not. And I wanted to have like a really cool writer answer for this. Like, oh, there's a totem that my grandfather gave me from, you know, the Korean War. But no, there's, you know, the majority of my writing is done on a laptop, in an office or in our camper when we're traveling. But I still, you know, I'll go to the woods with a pad and a pencil and I can write like that. I can go to the bar, the coffee shop in that long ago world that was February, and actually be out, you know, among people. But when I write in public, I tend to get a little distracted, and I don't know if that's an ego thing. Like, I can feel, you know, like, what do I look like while I'm typing or something? For me, it's just about being still and silent. It's, you know, a lot of people listen to music. I can't listen to music. I just have to be still and quiet and have that space. And then I can write. That's it. That's love like it. It's the most boring answer ever.
I love it. I love it. I absolutely love it. Okay. Question number three, how do you deal with the constant ups and downs of the writing life?
We talked about this kind of, you know, that was kind of the theme of this, this conversation. So, you know, actively I do, you know, meditate, go on hikes. Before I was a father, I used to work out. But I think the biggest thing is what we talked about earlier, which is just, I try not to tie my emotions to the ups or the downs, right? So if things are up, I try not to let myself float away. And if things are down, I try to remind myself just how privileged I am to be able to write. And I think that we can do that. I'm a full-time writer, but even before I was a full-time writer, if I was struggling, you know, with the words, I would just remind myself, like, this is really cool and really fun what we're doing, you know? And like we said earlier, it's really hard, right? It takes a leap of faith So you just have to be kind to yourself. You strike that balance between discipline, forcing yourself to, you know, sit down and get to work, and also just being kind to yourself and cutting yourself a little slack. So again, it's all nuanced, and the answer is usually somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Okay. Fourth question. If you could give one piece of advice to new writers, what would that be?
This is going to sound a little harsh, but only writing is writing, right? So I don't want to discourage people from going to conferences and workshops and being in writing groups. Certainly reading is super important, but at the end of the day, the only thing that, in my opinion, that separates writers from non-writers, it's not if you've been published, it's not if you've gotten good reviews or whatever. It's if you write. I mean, that's it. So as important as all those other things can be, and as beneficial and useful as all those can be, it really just, if you sit down and write, then you're a writer. And call yourself that too, by the way, because it's very empowering, right? Mm-hmm. I had a lot of people that were older and wiser than me when I was first starting out say, oh, so you're a writer. And I'm not a writer.
Right.
They're like, no, call, if you're writing, then call yourself a writer and give yourself that power and that encouragement. And so I think that's my one piece of advice is sit down and write and call yourself a writer.
I love it. So wonderful. Well, James, thank you so much for your time and congratulations on so many things. Your first published novel happening like within a month of your first child. It's so wonderful. It's been so great to talk to you. I really enjoyed this conversation and just your soul, like your spirit. You have such like a warmth to you that I just
I appreciate that. This was so much fun, and I'm honestly, the time flew by, man. I could have done this all day.
Same here. Well, thank you again. And one last thing, where can people find you if they want to like dig into more to James? What's the place?
I am active on all the terrible social medias. We got James Wade at James Wade Writer on Instagram, James Wade author on Facebook, and then my website is just jameswadewriter.com.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again. And until we speak again.
Thank you so much, okay. Brian.
Thank you again to James for his time. If you haven't yet, please take a moment and rate and review us on iTunes. You can also check us out on Instagram at instagram.com/howwriterswrite. And I want to say a special thank you to all of you listeners, and I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful week of writing.